What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded during TBRCon 2024, the latest edition of FanFiatic's all-virtual annual science fiction, fantasy, and horror convention, which streamed live between January 21st and January 28th, 2024. FanFiatic and TBRCon had the pleasure of hosting 25 amazing author panels, and we're so happy to be able to provide the audio for you for free here on the podcast feed. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy this fantastic TBRCon 2024 author panel.
Welcome to this panel, everyone. This panel is on horror across different cultures. My name is Xueting Ni. I'm your moderator for today. I'm a British Chinese writer and translator. I write about contemporary Chinese culture from both the traditional and pop aspects. And I'm also a literary translator, and I work across the different genres of SFF. And I'll let the guests introduce themselves. Shall we begin with Erica?
Sure. I'm Erica T. Worth. I'm author of White Horse, which is an Indigenous literary horror novel. I guess the highlights for me were that, you know, I was a Good Morning America Buzz pick. I was a Target Book of the Month and a New York Times editor pick. So
great. Thank you. Candice?
Hi, I am the creator of the Uncomfortably Dark Viewer and Indie Horror Support website. I'm an author, a publisher, an editor. I don't know, I do a little bit of everything.
Excellent, thank you. Ray?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Ray Knowles. I'm the author of Merciless Waters on the Stradivarius and co-editor of Scissor Sisters, which just came out yesterday. And that's an anthology of sapphic villains. And all of my work is queer.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Looking forward to reading that when I get the chance. And last but not least, I
actually just got the NetGalley of Scissor Sisters, so I'm very excited. But I'm Ai Jiang. I am a Chinese-Canadian writer of SFF and horror and an immigrant from Fujian. And I am the author of Linghun and I Am I.
Thank you very much. Excellent introductions. So let's start with our first question. Tell us a little bit about your journey into horror. When did you first develop a love of the genre and the fiction in the genre? And have you always been dark, or have you always been dark and disturbed? So I'll just briefly talk about it to start you off. So for me, I've always loved ghost stories. Ever since I was a child, I've loved kind of recreations of the Chinese underworld. I loved visiting any of those kinds of things. I loved going into caves and exploring. Just kind of, I was the sort of child that would see things in the dark and imagine things. So, so there's a part of me that's always loved kind of the mysterious and the dark. But then I think that I think that fear is a very common, as a universal emotion, and it's in a way kind of common to us all, this kind of fascination with the unknown and the mysterious, kind of the appeal of being slightly creeped out or very creeped out, you know, it's titillating being scared sometimes. So I'm going to go around the panel for this one, and then, you know, you can all jump in perhaps later when we get going. So should I start with, start with Erica?
Sure. Essentially, you know, I was just a super geeky kid, and if a book didn't have a dragon or an elf or a spaceship in it, I'm completely uninterested. I've said this 1,000 times, but someone tried to give me a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird, and I was just like, where are the dragons? You know, I wasn't interested. And, but when I went to college, I remember trying to argue that Stephen King was this important American writer, and they just laughed at me and laughed at me and laughed at me, even my friends did. And I, as strong-minded as I was, I did want to be taken seriously. And I do come from kind of a, you know, I guess a serious background. My dad was white, my mom indigenous, from completely different tribal backgrounds as well. And we're not members of federally recognized nations. We're urban Indians. And so it's, you know, my dad was an alcoholic and I was teased. So, you know, literary fiction just for at the time, it seemed to fit me for a long time because, you know, kind of promised this idea of respect and this idea of addressing serious issues. And so I went that way a long, long time. And then I started to watch Doctor Who again. And I read The Grossmans and Magicians. And I started to read what I wanted to read again and what I loved to read. And I realized like everything that I loved in literary fiction was absolutely in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And horror was the most natural fit because I just compulsively read horror the most when I was young, watched it. And it allowed me to hit some of those darker issues, but kind of still have that great paranormal and kind of fantastical element that I love. So.
Yeah, as you say, horror is really natural, is a very natural kind of thing to us all. And the boundaries between the literary and the non-literary, as we say, is kind of more blurred than some people might consider, particularly within horror, in a way. Candice?
I think I was mostly raised on it. So my mom and dad were paranormal investigators for a long time. And we were always open to things of the supernatural and ghost stories and hauntings and things. And there's a lot of experiences that we have had that yeah, I could probably tell you a few stories. I think I started to read Edgar Allan Poe when I was about 8 or 9, and then moved on to Hitchcock stories and Stephen King and everyone from there by the time I was about 10 or 11. We always watched a lot of horror movies, especially the really cheesy B-movies, and I don't know, it was just one of those things that we always had. We read it, we watched it, we told spooky stories at night, and it's pretty much the only thing I've ever wanted to write, so here I am.
Thank you. In a way, I mean, horror is definitely a literary space that we could address serious issues. But then sometimes, on the other hand, there is a lot to be said about, you know, having just the good old jumps and, you know, the gore, the kind of fun in being scared. So there seems like a lot of classic horror kind of storytelling that you've experienced. And also, I'm surprised you didn't rebel against your upbringing of, you know, being, you know, having parents who are paranormal investigators and kind of completely. That's fantastic. That's great. Ray, could we ask you to speak on this question?
Yeah, absolutely. First, I just have to say, though, Candice, we have to have a sidebar one day because I need to hear all of those stories. That sounds so fascinating and fun. Oh, I can only imagine. That's incredible. So I have always been drawn to darker things, both in media and in life. And a big part of who I am today is shaped by my journey through addiction and then into recovery. And I mention that because I think it has had a really profound impact on my connection to horror. I found that a lot of my writing is sort of about the horror of self-discovery. And in my own life, it was real life horrors that led me to take a hard look at difficult truths about myself. And I find my characters going on that journey quite a bit too. I just feel very, very tied to it. And the darker things in life and in fiction are really the only thing that holds my interest. So I think I'm here to stay.
That's really fascinating. I've never thought about it like that before. It seems that horror is a very personal, it's linked to a lot of personal experiences, and yet a lot of us can find things that resonate with us in the stories that you tell. And can I ask you to speak on this question?
Oh, my introduction to horror was a little rocky. So I didn't start loving horror. I remember the first time I saw a horror movie, it was The Poltergeist, and there was a clown in it. And I was like the most traumatized by it afterwards. And then there were a series of summer camp stories of Bloody Mary rituals in the bathroom and cabins with like dismembered bodies. And I had to sleep with the lights on for a week and asked my mom to also come into my room. At this point, I was like in middle school, and I was like, I shouldn't have my mom in my room, but I'm also scared. So, but then I think it was university when I really went into horror, but I was introduced not to writers like Stephen King, but kind of like Haunting of Hill House, Shirley Jackson, the quiet and broody atmospheric horror, and the ones that people might not or like, originally say is horror, which is beloved by Toni Morrison, kind of like the dark and violent histories. And it really drew me to kind of like horror movies that are not like The Poltergeist perhaps, but like social and psychological, like Parasite and Get Out, which kind of drew me to exploring things that we kind of have trouble voicing and kind of the things we have trouble understanding, including kind of ourselves and humanity as a whole, and kind of like the fears and anxieties I had growing up attached to identity and purpose, or like, you know, the education institution, employment, late life.
Thank you. So a mixture of influences there, which is really interesting. I always think it's very, so horror clearly works very well on you. And it's always useful when, you know, you write some horror and you get, if it really scares the writer, it probably will scare the reader. I mean, I'm quite terrible with horror films, especially the ones that are creepy and that are eerie kind of psychological horrors. Like, they stay with me for ages, and my family are like, no, don't watch that, because we won't be able to sleep, because you won't be able to sleep. So I always find that writers are so brave, to horror writers, to explore things that people, you know, that perhaps we don't want to face in the everyday lives. And the reverse side of society. So moving on to the next question, how is horror viewed in your culture, heritage, perspectives, and does this differ from more prevalent views in Anglophone sphere? I'll just talk briefly about Chinese horror. Yes, it's very different. The Chinese supernatural stories are a major way in which Chinese horror stems from originally. And the supernatural is not so super in traditional Chinese culture. Is quite natural in a way, kind of part of people see spirits and the unknown beings, unseen beings, as quite ghosts and things like that, as quite a normal part of life, that they kind of coexist but in a different plane. And a lot of the horror, the supernatural storytelling tradition, such as the Tales of the Strange, they are very much seen as part of the classical canon. And so this is why they're very much propagated still in modern society. They're printed, they're adapted and shown on primetime TV. And the more modern kind of horror genre is more problematic in a way. It's a lot more problematic. At the moment in China, the view of this genre is not too great. And there was a flourishing in the 2000s of the genre, but as a result, there was some kind of quite pulpy fiction that exploited gore and violence that came out. And also, like Slender Man in the US and Death Note in Japan, there were some very unfortunate copycat deaths. And this has led to the government to be quite heavy-handed about how they disapproved of the genre. And unfortunately, a lot of writers that made their names with this genre have been discouraged from writing it. And it's something that I'm trying to help change with my anthology. So from the view of horror in China, it's very different from how it is viewed in the Anglophone market, where it's quite in the Anglophone space, where it's quite established and more of a legitimate genre. So can I first ask I to speak on this topic, and then I'll just open it up to anybody who wants to contribute, if that's okay.
So my perspective is kind of like less so rooted in the mainland, but kind of like coming out as an immigrant in Canada and kind of being exposed to the horror genre here. And so whenever we are talking about ghosts and paranormal and the supernatural, I found that among like my friends who have arrived from China later in Canada, like later in their life, or kind of like my parents' generation and relatives, it is something undesirable to talk about rather than tackled with like curiosity and interest and wanting to kind of explore the genre more. They're kind of like, oh no, it's too scary. Let's not talk about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. But since I have returned to China a few months ago, I have talked to some of like the younger generations there. And what I've learned is that horror is much more popular amongst them now. And something I've been wondering is whether it has to do a lot with the pressures of schooling. Because when I'm here, when I am drawn to horror and write horror, it is because I am particularly in a difficult place in life or thinking about very difficult and psychological or social topics.
No, I think I definitely agree with that. I think it's a genre that really helps people deal with kind of the could help people deal with kind of some emotional difficulties in life. And in terms of the mainland, I think it definitely needs the genre, even though it's not viewed it's viewed as something very schlocky and low literature rather than something that deals essentially with the human heart like any other literary genre. And because a lot of social ills are emerging, are coming out of this kind of super glossy economic development, and the social issues that are trying to catch up with this rapid development, I think it's a genre that China really needs. I'll let the other guests contribute.
I actually speak about this a lot in some of my other work, but I actually think it's what one of those genres that we need in the experiences that I've had. Most people who don't read it or watch it, they simply don't understand where it's coming from, and they don't understand the differences between it. So you have all types. You have the extreme horror, you have splatterpunk, you have psychological, you have the thrillers and the ghost stories and paranormal and all of that. But hidden within each of those, you have the entire range of the human experience. And that's what I put in a lot of mine. It's the one place that I think we can put everything into. You can put heart into this. You can put love into this. You're putting grief and loss and emotion. You're putting fear, trauma, pain, nightmares, the things you're afraid of, the things that make you feel weak, the things that we want to hide from, and the things that we don't want to talk about because we remember. And it's not the experience we remember so much, although that is a part of it. It's the pain we remember. It's that emotional attachment of that experience we went through. In your heart and your mind, remember that pain. You remember what that fear felt like, or what that humiliation felt like, or what that grief was. And in polite society, those are things we don't talk about. That's why when you run into somebody at the store and you say, "Hey, how are you?" And their answer is always what? "Oh, I'm fine." You don't really want to know that their mother-in-law just died and their best friend has breast cancer and they survived a carjacking last month. You just want to know, "Hey, you're fine, good to go, let's move on," because those are the things we don't talk about. Those are the things we act like didn't really happen. We didn't go through and everything's fine. But what do those people do at the end of the day? Who do they talk to? Horror gives them someone to talk to, in a sense. It can kind of take them through the experiences that they don't talk about in a safe way. It lets them read about that and kind of process those things they went through safely in their own home, in their own space. It lets them sort of relive that. It lets them understand how they feel and why. And maybe at the end of it, it also lets them regain some of who they are and some of their strength back as well. I write about a lot of traumatic experiences. Why? Because I've gone through a lot of traumatic experiences. I could give you a whole rundown. I'm adopted. I was raised in an all-white town, an all-white home. I was the only Black student in my school. I knew racism was like, you know, an everyday part of my life. I also stuttered from the time I learned how to talk. I still do. I was humiliated constantly to the point to where I didn't even want to speak at all. Me doing something like this was almost unheard of like 2 or 3 years ago. And I'm still scared now. And I do this all the time. But I've had like so many emotional experiences that I write about it in the hopes that it helps me kind of go through those experiences in a safe way and maybe help somebody else kind of go through those same experiences too when they don't have no one to talk about it with. It's important and it helps.
Thank you so much for sharing the personal history with us. I really appreciate it. And that was a really amazing description of horror. I just wanted to write it down, maybe quote it at some later point. the kind of how all encompassing it can be. And this has come up in another panel, actually, that I was on, that it was suggested, do you like reading horror, writing horror, because it's not real and therefore it's okay to read it and be scared? Well, actually not quite. It's actually very real. Even if the situation is fictional, the emotions and fear the characters go through are very real, especially when you're kind of dealing with, you're writing about something that it's a result of, you're drawing from something that's from a real experience. I think horror definitely has this property of being able to, you know, we go through it and we work through the trauma and we come out not completely perfectly, but you know, we understand more about it and we kind of in a way come to terms with the experience a bit more, with the trauma a bit more afterwards. Could I ask Ray and Erica if you wanted to say anything about this?
Yeah, actually, why don't I go back to the original question, which was, what, you know, what is horror like in your culture? I think obviously there are so many different Native American nations, and what people do is they sometimes forget about Canada, but they especially forget about Mexico, they forget about Latin America and South America. And so within every single country within this continent and cultures, you're talking about wildly different situations originally and post-colonization. So my family, my father was white. I think I said this before, and my mom is sort of white Cherokee. She's black Chickasaw, and she's also Mexican Apache. I think there's some Irish in there too. So they're very, very different traditions. And we're all Stephen Graham Jones, Jessica Johns, Nick Medina. These are the, you know, newer horror writers alongside myself. It's a pretty new genre. I think that if people know anything about Native Americans, if they know about boarding schools or day schools, where a lot of our ancestors were forced or compulsed to go to these things, and we were not allowed to speak our languages in the boarding schools, especially. There were horrible abuses, physical abuses, sexual abuses. Especially people spoke their languages, they were stripped of their clothing, their culture, and told it was bad. And I think that now what I see a lot of when it comes to Native American horror or Native American fantasy, especially with my friend Rebecca Roanhorse, who's on that dark fantasy side of things, is, you know, that people say, well, it's taboo to talk about those things if it's the traditional thing. But I think that with, like, obviously there are myriads of ways in which individuals within tribes, within families, right, within nations perceive things. I think that more than anything, it's a, you know, a thing that was quite literally beaten out of us. And I think it is important for us to, you know, tap into those traditions and utilize them in an imaginative way. And as my friend Rebecca Roanhorse said, otherwise, we're just sort of pumping out European things like the vampire. I love the vampire. I will watch any vampire movie ever created. And certainly if some Native person wrote a tremendous vampire novel, I would enjoy it. But there's something cool about seeing the way, for example, Nick Medina takes his traditions, puts it in sort of an imaginary reservation and puts his imagination on top of it, right? Like you do, and creates, you know, like, what is it? They have like a head. Like a headless creature, a head that runs around the res and like terrorizes people. And I just love that because it's cool to see us tap into our own stuff and be incredibly poetic and completely imaginative with it at the same time and have fun and hit those hard issues wherever you are on that spectrum, or if you're with both. I like to think I'm both. So.
Wow, thank you. Can I just clarify just for my own understanding that are you saying that it's taboo to talk about the issues within those communities or to write horror in that's related to your cultures?
I don't want to speak for every Native person in any way, and there are those in my community who think that they do, but I would say that at times I have heard some natives say that, oh, well, we can't talk about these stories because that's taboo. But the thing about it is that I don't think it's as much taboo as it is things that were literally physically beat out of our ancestors in these boarding and day schools. So I think that's where that hesitation comes from. That is just my opinion.
Oh, I see. Yeah, very interesting. I must say, I have started reading your book a few days ago, and because I hardly know anything about the cultures of your native tribes, so I have no idea how the story will go at all, and I'm kind of really excited to see how it will go. And, you know, the dark things are starting to happen, and you know, there's tremendous excitement about kind of when you're coming into something totally new, a new kind of rhetoric and storytelling from perhaps what you're used to. Ray, did you want to say something about this? How horror is viewed in from your perspectives, and does it differ from more prevalent views of the Anglophone sphere?
Yeah, so I've definitely heard a theme in what a lot of us have shared, in horror being a mechanism for processing trauma and responding to trauma. And I think within queer culture, media through the Hays Code in the United States and in other ways has sought historically to erase queer people from existence. Or, you know, if you're of my generation, I grew up with all the very thinly veiled queer Disney villains, which was, you know, interesting. So either we don't exist, or maybe we kind of exist, but definitely evil if we do. So that's sort of the context, at least, you know, for me, from my perspective as a queer person. And what I see happening that I think is really cool right now within queer horror is first, a real embracing of erotic horror, which I think is fantastic on so many levels. I think it's a really feminist response to what we've seen in maybe splatterpunk genres and extreme horror, where the eroticism is heavily misogynistic and heteronormative and doesn't feel great maybe for some people to read. So I think that's really cool. And I'm also seeing a reclamation of the tropes that have been leveraged against queer people for so long. So obviously, you know, I'm just put out Scissor Sisters, which is very clearly intended to be a reclamation of the trope of a predatory lesbian. I'm also, I have an advanced copy of Bury Your Gaze, which is the anthology coming out from Sophia Ajram, obviously, you know, intending to reclaim the Bury Your Gaze trope. And I think it's really powerful and empowering to have people tell their own stories and very intentionally engage with these tropes that have been harmful in the past, and to just blow it out of the water, right? Because I think when people tell their own stories, there's simply no contest to when they're tried to tell, other people try to tell them for us, right? So those are just a couple things that I think I see happening, and totally agree that horror is the perfect venue to really rumble with trauma in interesting ways.
Thank you. I've read some of your erotic horror short stories, and they're definitely not heteronormative. they're really excellent. So in a sense, in the broader sense, the queer perspective can mean, as well as kind of gender and sexuality, it's a way of looking at any subject, or a way of approaching a form of writing or anything that is kind of challenging of the norm, the established norm, which may not have been established on a very kind of egalitarian basis. So I think in your writing, you definitely do that.
Thank you.
So moving on to our third question, do you think that distinct subject matters, approach and styles of horror from othered cultures or queer perspectives enriches horror storytelling as a whole? Please talk a little about your perspective. That question was quite convoluted, but I hope it was clear. So I think from my culture, definitely, I think it definitely does enrich horror storytelling, in that you have firstly, you have like the very basic of you have the basis of a very different tradition with its tropes and kind of traditions and tropes and the kind of whole trappings of horror is different when you're reading fiction that's not from another culture, horror fiction, and therefore it's the novelty of those elements. But then also you have like the pacing and the rhythm is very important to horror storytelling, particularly the ones where you have the jumps and the surprises, and because it's so much about the unexpected. So I think horror from other traditions works very well, even though the tropes and traditions and the rhythm is very familiar to people from that culture, it could be very unique and new, provide a new experience for people outside of that. Lastly, the causes of horror, as opposed to the fear itself, kind of can be all kinds of reasons, can be very different. And this kind of concerns the more psychological and social horrors, where the environments that the writer creates to provide the context for the horror the characters are experiencing is really important, can be really unique depending on the perspective of the writer and the culture that they're from. Could I ask Erica to speak about this topic?
Sure. Look, you know, a million years ago when I was still writing what I like to call realism, because I don't think literary is a genre, it's a series of conventions that can be applied to any genre, right? I had a little book out, a little press, and I was asked by publishers, Weekly Marketplace to write, you know, should we read diverse literature? And I guess my answer now is the same, which is why are we still, why is this matter in some ways, right? Do we ever say, you know, is it worth it? Is our white men who are straight, should we read them? You know, and so I kind of think the answer is sort of in the question, like, you know, regardless of ethnic background, obviously you're capable of producing terrible novels, right? Just terrible on an aesthetic level. And yet we're also, like, regardless of your background, you're capable of writing wonderful novels. And I think that obviously my friend Stephen Graham Jones, similar to me, he wrote realism for years and years and years, and it just got weirder and weirder and weirder, if that's possible. And then it really became clearly horror, right? And that's, like me, that was his first love, although I think I was much geekier than him as a kid. And I think that he's widely considered to be the sort of postmodern horror king, right? And so, I think that all of us should be able to have the resources. And I work, if anybody knows me, right, and especially in my community, I work incredibly hard to make sure this happens, to the point where it's certainly had it's been a detriment to me, but I don't care. I've worked really hard to make sure that regardless of how good or bad or unique or whatever the work is, we have, like, natives and other BIPOC and other and queer folks have those same access points, because I think everyone deserves to have access to writing good or bad books, right? So
yeah, absolutely. It's kind of being able to get for everyone to be able to get their voice, the writer's voice out, whether it's good or bad are considered, you know, that's for, I suppose, the reader to decide. And, you know, there's a lot of unfortunate gatekeeping that happens where some writers that are less the more disadvantaged have kind of less opportunities of getting their work out there, which you're as you say, you've been working to kind of remove.
It's getting better, if I can intercede one more time. Look at R.F. Kuang. She is an absolute, although the weird thing with the Hugos thing, I don't know, but like she is a stunner of a writer. And her Yellow Face, her Babel, completely different books are really moving forward. I think people are really starting to see writers like her as exactly what she is, which is, you know, she's a genius. Anyway, moving on.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I feel like the world is kind of more welcoming to writers of all different kinds today than it was like maybe 10 or 20 years ago. Writers are really getting their, you know, getting more chances of publishing on different platforms than before, which is really great development. Do any of the other guests want to say, discuss this question?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think you're dead on, Erica. And I think it's so important that people in positions of power in this industry, the decision makers who can say yes or no, get really intentional about making space for this. And there's, you know, lots of different ways they can do that. But I think you touched on something really important, which is that horror across different cultures, storytelling across different cultures, the pacing is going to differ, right? The flow might differ. It might not be what that white, straight, Christian male editor has seen a million times before, and good. But because of that, we need to make room for that and be intentional about looking for stories that do change it up from what we've seen 1,000 times before. Because I think I can probably speak for most people when I say, I love a comfort watch as much as anyone, but do I want to hear the same story over and over for the rest of my life? No. I mean, of course, horror from different cultures enriches the genre as a whole. And I just think it's so important that those decision makers understand their own biases, the patterns that they're used to in pacing and maybe what they're used to in prose and in characterization, and understand that that's not the same across the board, and be willing to take that extra beat of consideration for folks that are not of their culture, so they can step back and say, is this something I'm not connecting with? Right? Like I have so much trouble when I hear that as feedback, like didn't connect with it.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt and intercede, but really just as somebody who's been in the industry for so long, I have found that it is mainly straight white people who have like big postmodern projects, pacing, you know, the structure isn't the traditional beats. The language is much more flowery. A lot of my friends who are BIPOC and certainly Indigenous, absolutely, and I'm one of them, go to those traditional beats. They have the absolute traditional beats in that way, in the traditional structure. It's that traditional structure isn't European. It's like a conglomeration of things that ended up being the modern screenplay and the modern novel. So for me, it really does go back to, like you say, it's not just connection, it's unease. It is like, is this Indigenous? That makes me feel guilty. You know, and then they'll try to go back to like the things they know, like, okay, let's talk about Indigenous people in the past, and let's talk about Blackness, and only in regards to slavery, right? We don't want anything contemporary. And so I think it's about unease more than it is about pacing, because an academic who is surrounded by postmodern writers, surrounded by those people, they were primarily white. So I think that what has to happen is that these industries have to give ground to power, and they don't want to. They have to have editors, agents who are of color. They don't work queer. They have to have them, because it's less about that than I found anyway. And it's more about just like, ugh, No, they'll connect if they want to, but they feel so much guilt immediately. That's their first response that they don't even try to connect. So anyway, yeah. Really does stop interrupting and babbling. So.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a great distinction, Erica. And I think you're absolutely right. And I also think a lot of people will maybe tell themselves, well, I didn't connect for reasons A, B, and C, when the reality of it is what you just described. But that's harder to say.
I mean, there are many, each culture has its own kind of horror tradition, but actually there are a lot of universal things about fear and kind of the ways that we are afraid. But then on the one hand, if we're really, we're always, you know, the fear is always generated in the fiction in the same way with the same rhetoric, then horror is one of the, you know, major genres where people are going to be like, they're going to be bored and they're just going to, you know, laugh at it. If, you know, they're expecting that the rhetoric and it's not new anymore, if it doesn't surprise them anymore. So, and you're absolutely right that we need kind of multiculturalism in writers and in editors and publishers, but also in the sales team who make the decisions about the acquisition and the play a huge part in the making a decision in the acquisition and also in the kind of the packaging of the works that they're bringing out. How if they're, you know, they need to be prepared to trust the writer that this is appropriate from their perspective and from their culture. If it comes with this set of supplementary, you know, packaging and how it's promoted, I'll let the other two guests. Did you want to say something about this? I mean, it's in a way, it's fairly obvious that it's fairly clear that different cultures do enrich horror storytelling, but I'm sure there's a lot you can discuss about from your perspectives or cultures.
I was just going to add that I think it is important now more than ever to hear from everyone. All walks of life, all races, genders, identities. We learn from one another. We learn from experiences, and reading what others have went through, why they went through that, or how they reacted. That's how we learn, and that's how we grow and evolve and understand what other people go through, what their life is like. It all comes back to that, you know, walk a mile in someone else's shoes. If you don't experience anything else through anyone else's eyes, you can't grow, you can't learn, you can't really evolve past what you know, because you're right here. You're maintaining your own walk of life, and that's exactly where you stay. And I think now, with so many different voices in the industry, and not just within horror, but all fiction, writers need to be heard, we need to be seen, and we need to be represented everywhere, every voice, every style. Now is the perfect time, because we're out there and there's more people of alternate lifestyles and queer lifestyles and Native Americans and Black people and just cultures from just everywhere now that actually have the chance to be seen and heard. And I think it's great. So.
Thank you. I hope there are publishers and editors who are listening to this panel, and I hope they take note of the discussions today and make it a more welcoming kind of publishing sphere and reading sphere for everyone. Could I ask I to comment on this topic?
So I will try to articulate my thoughts after hearing everyone else's, because it's such a complicated, but also not complicated topic in a way. And I was kind of just thinking about how, while some people are curious or interested to find out about what or who they don't understand, there are others who might fear what they don't understand. And it makes me think about the things I've read about the fear of immigrants and the fear of immigrants, but not just immigrants, but also BIPOC and queer folks, and how it always centers around uncertainty and instability and kind of like a lack of belonging. And there are a lot of different perspectives, I think, that if people are more exposed to, they can kind of grow to become more empathetic and accepting, kind of step out of their own shoes and understand others, kind of like many people might see coming of age as YA, but then to some coming of age, they might come of age twice in life, and it can be a horror in itself, and the fear of starting over or building from little to nothing, and how fear in one person's world could be inexistent in another's, or one person's dystopia is another's utopia, and kind of the way society might favor some of us while continuously fail others in a way that not all of us might notice or kind of understand. And one interesting thing I was thinking a lot about lately is kind of the fear as a luxury for some people, as entertainment, something they can just tap into when they want to, whereas fear might be an unending reality for other people. And some people just don't understand that because they don't really see it outside of their own life. And so when I was younger, I came from more like brink of poverty, economic status, because that's where my family first immigrated to Canada. And kind of within one culture, you might see differences in that. My parents would be worried about income, but then they would never make me think that there was like not enough, if that makes sense, even though we were in the same situation, you know, like even when we got a house and they would have to rent out all the rooms, they would fear things like, oh, we have two children, and there are a bunch of strangers in the house, and there's no lock because we had to stay in the living room kind of thing. But then me as a child in that situation, I'm just like, whoa, look, we have a house, you know, so.
Yeah, I think as a child, you always kind of take everything as natural, even though you look back and it was quite a very daunting experience and scary. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your personal experiences. And I think it's really, really very astute, very perceptive to point out that one person's dystopia might be another person's, one person's, you know, happiness might be another person's dystopia. And there's so much in horror that's to do with perspectives. And it absolutely is a genre that helps us understand the fears and concerns of others, and how, and helps us to see things from their perspective, from their kind of perspective, and by kind of being kind of channeled into their shoes in a way by these stories, and feeling and thinking about what they think and feel, particularly if it's a very different mode of existence to ours. Thank you. That's really fantastic. So moving on to our penultimate question then, of what do you think of horror writing? What do you think of horror writing as it is today? I think a lot of what you guys just commented on, what you folks just commented on, really kind of led on to this very well. So what do you think of the genre as it is today, and what are you excited and happy about, and what are you angry about, and what would you like to change? I'm just going to open this up to the guests who would like to comment, who would like to discuss this first.
Yeah, I can start, I guess.
Great.
So
thank you.
What do we think of it as it is now? I think we're in a very exciting time frame right now. I think with the amount of inclusion and representation right now that has come out in just the last 5 years alone has been amazing. And I think we're going to be in for a lot more of it over the next 5 to 10 years. And hopefully it is here to stay. Like, I hope we stay here and we just continue to expand and expand and welcome more and more and more, because there's a place here for everybody. There's a reader for every single story, and there's somebody out there that can relate to every single story. Someone can understand what I write and why, and there's someone out there that can understand what Ray has written and why, and what Erica has went through and why. There's a reader for every story, and I think that needs heard, and those stories need to be told. And right now there's just a lot of them out there, and it's great.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So there's a writer for every kind of story, and a reader, or 100 readers for every kind of story there is. Yeah, we're in the post Get Out world of horror. It's certainly a very dynamic one. Oh, sorry, somebody wanted to, did I hear that somebody wanted to speak?
I'm happy to go. I'll just go quick. Look, there's a Native American Renaissance in general happening. I've friends in, realism. There are, B.L. Blanchard, Rebecca Roanhorse in fantasy, Stephen Graham Jones, Jessica Johns, Nick Medina in horror. I mean, science fiction, Daniel H. Wilson, if you haven't read him, he's actually been around for a while. He's fantastic. He's got a new one coming out. And if you told me that these books would have existed in the future when I was young, I wouldn't have even known what to do with that. I absolutely will continue to, like I said, work hard to make sure there are more and more opportunities, but this is an astonishing time. I love seeing what's out there. And I think that it's not just about what we can get to non-us, it's about the conversations we're having with one another. That actually matters more to me, so.
Absolutely, the conversations we have with each other through reading, through writing, through discussing these works, and just kind of communicating, exchange. Yeah, it's so important.
Yeah. I agree that it's a really exciting time. And I feel at the same time, we still have miles to go with queer representation in particular, and especially talking about the big books that get, more money behind them through traditional publishing. I think there remains certain queer representation that is felt to be marketable or acceptable, and anything kind of falling outside of that, we see a lot less of on that stage. I think the world of indie horror is a lot more exciting and a lot more flavorful and varied in that way, but not without issues of its own. And I totally agree that these kinds of conversations are important. I think there's a need for transparency. Going back to what we were kind of mentioning earlier is, I think there's a huge need for power to show the same diversity that the readership shows.
That's a fantastic way of putting it. The an important the need for power to say, to show the same kind of diversity as the readership shows. It's time for the power to listen to the readership. Yeah, there is. I can see that there is absolutely kind of ways of acceptable and commercial ways of being queer that publishers tend to go for, and other ways that are not so acceptable. And whereas it all needs to be acceptable, and we need to have all their voices need to be heard. So I think it is.
Just to echo my fellow panelists, I think there's definitely an increase in diversity amongst horror, but there always can be more, and I would love to see more. But I think what is fascinating is that a lot of people who shy away from horror previously, both readers and writers, are now becoming unafraid to step out and kind of explore the uncomfortable and the personal. And because the genre itself has broadened so much, there is, like Candace was saying, a reader for every story, and kind of like a broader acceptance of what horror is, like the quieter and the louder horror, and what it can be. So.
Yeah, it does certainly feels like there's more general acceptance of what horror can be, not just the narrow kind of definition of it, the narrow definition it tended to have before, or maybe the certainly in the Anglophone reader sphere, in the readership, in the market, there's a kind of a diversification, that there's a less of the view that horror is kind of and not proper literature, but that there's a lot you can do in horror. You can have kind of quite a subtle psychological horror or social horror. You could have the ones that are more about adventures and kind of the jump scares and the monsters, and some that are more metaphorical, and you know, you can have real monsters or kind of imagined ones. And there's blending of genres as well, horror and sci-fi, horror and historical fiction. It's definitely a genre that seems to be on the rise at the moment. It seems to be kind of, we're several years after the lockdown, and we seem to have gone through a period of very kind of people liking kind of cozy utopias and kind of very sort of escapist fiction. And now we're kind of more ready to deal with, I think, perhaps the less savory side of recent experiences, and also generally other types of traumas or concerns that might be, you know, recent kind of political developments or social developments around the world may have generated, apart from the pandemic. It seems to be really, really positive time, although there is definitely the need for more kind of even more diversity. It's definitely not a perfect, not an ideal world yet. So I think we've definitely got some time for questions. If we can, let me check the comments section to see, and if the audience have any questions, if you could pop them into the comment section. No, does anyone have any questions they would like to ask? That is one cute cat.
I see one in the chat now.
Yeah, great. Yep. I see it too. Yep. I'm trying to pull it up. Okay. What aside from, so this is a question from Eshambo06. What aside from empathy can white male cis writers in the community do explicitly to help with this problem? Is this making sense? What aside from empathy can white male cis writers in the community do explicitly to help with the problem of?
Yeah. I got it, yeah. And I'm happy to answer. Erica. Why don't we? And I've published again. I have a doctorate in creative writing and literature. I published 2 books of poetry with small presses, a collection of short stories with an indie press, same thing, small press, 2 novels, 1 university press, and then now I'm with the Big Five. So I would say, and I've written on this issue a lot. And so here's what I would say, you know, if people love a book, if they become aware, like, oh, you know what, I love Stephen King. I just want to say, like, I'm reading the entire Dark series right now, Dark Tower series right now. So I have no problem with people reading straight white males. I do all the time. But if people are aware, like, oh, that's all that I've been exposed to, and then they start to read widely, it's really okay. You're going to not like every book because, again, you know, we are people, and some of us are going to produce either bad books or books that just don't appeal to everybody, and that's all right. But if you do like a book and you start to read really, really widely, genuinely, and if you have any biases, they start to be evened out because you're actually exposing yourself. Sounds creepy, and it is, you know what I mean. And if you love a book, do put it on TikTok, do put it on social media, do talk to your friends about it, you know. Join those listservs for Penguin and small presses and big presses and all of them, and really see what's coming out there. You know, read the articles to see what's coming out. Read those books, you know, promote those books. I think it really does matter when people say, you know what, my tastes are wide and here's a book I really love. And that's something that I've always done, even when my microphone was really tiny. The other thing that I always recommend to other writers if they're trying to promote a book, but even if you have like a master's degree in journalism or English or something where you're required to really hone your writing skills, you can pitch places, different places on the internet. I have articles with BuzzFeed or LitHub with articles like 10 Indigenous writers, you know, and that made a huge difference for me as a writer. And I think those articles popping up really do matter. So.
Any of the other guests want to answer this question? We have 3 more questions now.
I would just say to speak out about those that you have read, those that you have enjoyed, and keep yourself open to reading others, lifting others, supporting others, not just white cis male writers, but everyone. Read from everyone, keep an open mind, and lift and talk about everyone that you've read. You liked it. Be objective about it. You may not relate to the actual person who played the lead. Maybe you're not queer. Maybe you're not Black. But did you relate to the experiences in the story? What did you like about it? Did you like the writing style? Did you enjoy it? Would you read another story from that author? Those are all those different things that are relatable within all works, whether it came from me, you, or the guy next door. They all have things in them we can find to relate to regardless of where it came from. Just lift and read and stay open to everyone.
You know, someone in the questions is asking writers that we'd recommend, because they came in later. And I remember something in the email about that being something. And so I want to reiterate, Nick Medina is Sisters of the Lost Nation, Jessica Johns, Bad Creek, Stephen Graham Jones, obviously people have read him. And someone was asking if something about experimental literature. Stephen is, you know, hit the New York Times bestseller list, but he's a very experimental writer. He's very postmodern. And I can never stop recommending Rebecca Roanhorse. I think she is probably the most transformative, important Native writer we have ever had. So her Black Sun is brilliant. All of her books are brilliant. Black Sun is brilliant. So if anyone else has, you know, writers that they'd recommend.
I really, really do enjoy Rebecca's work too. So I think we'll move on to the next questions. How can we help directly with the problem? Okay, this one is part of the first one. Next question. I haven't been around for the whole discussion, but in terms of, this is what the one that Erica answered. Okay, sorry. So anybody wants to recommend any horror writers or any kind of any writers?
I have sort of a more broad recommendation, which is to pick up an anthology that's focused on a marginalized group. Because what's fantastic about anthologies is you get all of these opportunities to discover the writers that you're going to love, the styles that are really going to work for you. Because I can recommend my favorites all the time, and it may or may not click with your preferences. But if you pick up, you know, something like Never Whistle at Night with the idea that, okay, I'm going to discover some Indigenous writers this way, you know, or Scissor Sisters or Barrier Gaze with the idea that you want to identify more queer writers, then you have the opportunity for yourself to pick the ones that, I love this style. I want to see more like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Anthologies are a great way to find out about writers that you haven't read before. You know, you read a short story, it doesn't take a long time, kind of a lot of space to commit to the story, and then you can kind of find out more about their work. If you like their work in particular, yeah, it's a great way of kind of reading new writers, the writers that are new to you.
I have a few shorter recommendations. So Bound Feet by Kelsea Yu, and then Help Meet by Naben Ruthnam, Hungers as Old as This Land by Zachary Rosenberg, and short stories by, I'm sorry about the name, H. Puyo.
Thank you. Yeah, that's nice and clear. Thank you. In terms of, I would recommend, of course, the Sinophagia anthology that's coming out next year. 14 horror writers that haven't been published in English before. More for the sake of them than that it's my anthology. But also the Valancourt anthology of world horror, particularly the second volume, I found to be really excellent and really kind of introduced me to horror traditions and writers I haven't come across before. Oh, thank you for dropping it into the chat. That's great. Okay. Is there anything, so the next question, is there anything really experimental or pushing boundaries in the genre you'd like to write? This is from Nancy Nguyen. Is there anything really experimental or pushing boundaries in the genre you'd like to write? So this can be horror or not horror, whatever your you write in, whatever genre you're writing in. Any guess?
So I'll share. I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but I'm going to respond in the way I think is what you mean. I have read some really cool work with epistolary elements, and that is something that I would love to play with more in my future work. Not a horror book, but my favorite book ever is This Is How You Lose the Time War, and it has major epistolary elements throughout and super poetic prose to the point of just being straight up poetry a lot of the time, and in my opinion. So yeah, I would love to personally play more with epistolary elements. I'm also seeing in the chat a mention of Eric LaRocca. I want to say his most famous work, Things Have Gotten Worse Since We Last Spoke, is also an epistolary story. So another cool example of that.
Thank you. Epistolary writing. That sounds really interesting. Not something I'm very super aware of.
There was one thing I talked about working on in last year's StokerCon, which is I have this thing with haunted houses, and I wanted to do something like a tangible haunted house almost, so you can see it visually, not just kind of read about it, because my spouse is an architect, so we wanted to do kind of like a collab where he actually makes the haunted house I write about and put it in the book and play around with the structure and things like that. So we will see how that goes.
Oh, wow. So that's kind of like immersive horror experience. That's kind of beyond the text, beyond the page, that you can certainly pushes the boundaries of experience.
Yeah, Eric LaRocca is just a badass, cool person to boot. As far as those kinds of immersive experiences, I did do a room in Meow Wolf, if you know what it is. If you don't, you could always Google it. They're basically immersive art installations. The first is Santa Fe, the second one's in Denver. And I did do an Indigenous Futurism one. So if you're ever in Denver, if you want to look up Meow Wolf, I'm in there. As far as experimental, I think that's such a, to me, that's kind of a word sometimes people poke each other with. They're like, I'm experimental, are you experimental? And then there's nothing like, what is it? You know, but I can say that in my next novel that's under contract, that's now titled Handbook of Ceremonies, it's through several titles, I have a lot of like eBay, like it starts with like a haunted object, because I'm really fascinated by all the haunted objects that are on eBay. And so like, it starts with a lot of those, and it starts with a lot of, you know, I end up, you know, how there are these places you can buy like ghost, like, I think Candace, you said something about your parents being ghost hunters. Well, there are places you can buy ghost hunting equipment. So I made up one, and I made up equipment. And so I'm hoping to actually kind of link, one of my readers actually said, you know, you should, I went to see if there was an actual website called Ghost Equipment for Real. And she's like, you should have one. And so I'm going to totally see my team. Flatiron Boy has been very supportive. Will do that for me, because that just sounds rad. So, yeah. So if that's experimental.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it to me. Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly kind of some interest in this kind of paranormal reality, kind of real paranormal experiences, both in terms of like fiction, documentary style fiction, but also kind of maybe the actual experiences. Maybe that's something that Candace can talk about, because you said your parents were a paranormal kind of professionals in. Yeah. I can't remember the term that you used.
Paranormal investigations. So they did that for about 17 years, 15, 16 years. But they were always open to that. And my dad lived in a highly active house when he was a child, extremely active, to where things were moving and lifting off the ground and like voices and objects moving around. So we heard a lot of these stories when he was a kid. And then when my brother passed away, I was 24 when he died, they kind of went back into the whole paranormal investigation again, and they formed a team. And we did a lot of overnight investigations and went around the different houses and institutions just to try to see if there was any truth to what we had heard or what we were told from whoever owned each house or each spot. And we had it all. Like, we had the EVPs and the ghost speaker box, which is sort of like a radio device to where if there's a spirit attempting to communicate, it'll pop out different words on the radio frequencies. And there was just a lot of different pieces of things that we had used, but there was one. it was like a light box, and there was a green light and a red one. And if there was a spirit in the room who couldn't actually speak or communicate some other type of way, the idea behind how it worked was if they got near to the green light, it would light up based on their energy. And then if they got near the red one, it would light up. So you were able to ask some easy, like, yes and no's, like, did you live here? And if it wanted to say yes, it would light up on the green. Did you die here? It would light up on the green or on the red or whatever. You couldn't really ask too many questions with that one. But if you knew what you wanted to ask and how, you could usually get a yes and a no with those. The one, I remember one place we were in a, it was a institution that had been an orphanage at one time, a poor house at another, and then it had transitioned into a geriatric home. Not a good one, you know, back when and things. But one of the spirits there had taken a liking to my oldest daughter who was with us. And he kept wanting to communicate with her. My father was asking if he was touching her because her hair kept lifting. And my dad would ask, are you touching my granddaughter? And the green light bulb would light up. And then my daughter would move across the room and her hair would lift up again. And we would ask it again. And my dad was like, do you like my daughter? And it would say, yes, you know. It was just weird. There's a lot of things that you can say about, okay, well, it could have been this, that, and the other. But it was the consistency of the questions that he asked and how many times it said yes and how many times it said no. And that one spot that we were in was an actual, like, highly active spot. So I'm going to go ahead and say that one was probably one of the more realistic experiences compared to so many other places we went to where everyone claimed it was haunted, it was active, and then we sat there all night long. There was just nothing. So, you know, What, Erica?
I love Erica? These stories.
Yeah.
You have to take a lot of them with a grain of salt, you know, because what someone hears in the middle of the night, it can be their pipes, it can be the foundation, it can be, you know, the wind or the tree outside. But there are some, there are some that are real. And I can tell you for sure that I've had plenty of experiences that are real. So how much time we got? We got a few.
We're just coming perfectly, the perfect time to wrap up. Thank you.
If you want, like, I can cut it down to like 3 minutes if you want to hear this one.
A quick story. Mm-hmm. So let's see if we're meant to finish at 5:30. So let's do the wrap up first, and maybe you can end the panel with your story. I think that would be a very apt thing to end it with. So what are you working on, and what we can what can we look forward to from you this year? So this is the wrap up to tell us if there's anything that you also are, you know, if there's anything, any past projects that you're particularly proud of, you can also highlight them. Just tell us what you're working on and what you're, what we can look forward to you, what we can look forward to from you in the near future. From myself, just quickly, I've been working on my anthology, the first contemporary Chinese horror fiction anthology, Sinophagia, and that's coming out in September. So I'll be doing plenty of things to promote it, including some sample leaflets before the publication. I'm also working on my next non-fiction. Can't really talk about that too much yet. It will be a book on Chinese, another aspect of Chinese culture. So I have I'm quite proud of Synopticon, my science fiction anthology, which came out a couple of years ago, and you can read that now and get it now. 13 different science fiction authors collected in one volume. And I'm back on the kind of the lecture and talk circuit. So you'll hear more from me talking about Chinese culture and SFF in general in the coming year or so. Can I ask Erica to tell us what you're working on and what we can look forward to from you?
Sure, I talked about it earlier. I just turned in what is hopefully beginning to be the final edits to Flatiron for my book under contract. It's called Handbook of Ceremonies, and essentially it's about a woman who was finishing her PhD in psychology, and her sister calls her up and she's like, if you don't come to the Brown Palace, local hotel in Denver, I'm going to die. And she's like, just come here. I'm celebrating my doctorate. No. And that night, her sister, as far as she knows, commits suicide. She appears to her, and her powers, if you will, are kind of turned on. And she and her mother just are distraught. The main character is unable to go into academia. And so she becomes a paranormal detective, because that's what, you know, now she has this, like, these powers that are turned on. But then the Brown Palace calls her years later and says, no, you need to come in. This woman's been haunting. Every 5 years, you know, a woman dies in the same room your sister died in, and we want you to take on the case. And she's like, absolutely not. But then her mother checks in, and she knows her mother has 3 weeks to live if she doesn't take this case on. So, and hand for ceremonies.
I love the name. It sounds, just the name really appeals already. And the story, of course. Ray, what are you working on, and what projects are you proud of, and what can we look forward to from you?
Sure. So I mentioned Scissor Sisters, an anthology of sapphic villains, came out yesterday. You can get that wherever books are. I also have a co-written novel coming out February 20th, I want to say, called Lies That Bind. It's erotic horror. It's incredibly explicit. So please read the trigger warnings and mind them fully. I mean them with my whole heart. But I'm excited about that coming up. I'll be at StokerCon, which I'm very excited about. So hopefully I get to meet some of you in person there.
Mark your calendars, everyone. Trigger warnings is something that I've learned quite recently that I've put in my upcoming book as well. It's very useful thing to have for people, I think. Could you tell us what you're working on and what we can look forward to?
So I have like a cli-fi steampunk fantasy thing coming out with Titan Books in 2025 titled A Palace Near the Wind. And I've been doing a lot of research about my hometown and home province in Fujian recently. And I'm thinking about doing kind of like a series of different genre works based on it. And I've been kind of collecting family accounts of their past, and kind of like putting it in a thing to remember them by in a way, but it will be horror. because it was quite horrifying.
That sounds fascinating, like your personal book of Fujian, but celebrated in all kinds of genres. Yeah, so looking forward to that. And Candice, can you tell us your the projects you're working on, and also what we can look forward to, what were you publishing soon, and your story?
My story. Let's see. I just became a official indie publisher, so I have a full release schedule for this year. I have 6 projects that are coming out throughout 2024 with the authors I've signed. For myself, I have 4 novels coming out, 6 novellas coming out, 2 collections, actually 3, and then the new anthology for the publishing house also that hasn't been announced yet, but probably will be here in the next week or two. So full slate ahead.
That's a lot. How'd you get the time? I'm making mental notes, which I need to go and write down for all these.
I don't sleep much. So I'm going to cut this real short, and any questions you guys can get at me later. So my brother passed away when I was 24. So it was 1999. The evening he died, we were all at my mom and dad's house, or childhood home. We were all raised there. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. A lot of you are familiar with grief and the state of mind you're in and all of that. I was wide awake. We were all wide awake. None of us were ready to be asleep yet, but we were all in our individual rooms, just kind of waiting for the next day, you know. And I'm laying down facing the window, and there's a door like back here. The door opens. It was shut, like fully shut. The knob turns, the door opens, sliding across the rug. You can hear that shh sound, right? So I'm looking, I don't see anything. Footsteps, and then the edge of my bed sinks in. My brother was 6'2", a good 275 pounds. Sinks in, you can smell him. Like, you could smell my brother, the aftershave he wore, and you could smell the scent of blood because he died violently. So you could smell like the very, very heavy scent of blood. And I'm seeing the mattress sink in, and then all of a sudden his hand is right here. And I just hear, I'm here and I'm okay. And then he rises, the bed lifts up again, back to normal. My door closes and he walks off down the hallway. The next day I find out that every single one of us in the house that night all got a visit from him. That same night he came and he checked on all of us.
Wow.
So, yeah. He stayed at my mom and dad's house for 12 years after he died. A solid 12 years to where we all have had multiple experiences with him, and friends of ours also experienced this repeatedly. So,
and on that spooky note, we are going to have to end our panel. Thank you so much for all the guests. You've been all amazing, and I hope anybody tuning in really enjoyed it. I certainly did. It was my pleasure to moderate this panel.
Thank you.
Thank you.